Welcome to Movie Crush, a production of iHeartRadio.
Hey, and welcome to Movie Crush. This is Charles W. Chuck Bryant in the home studio, Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia. Friday interview a dish with my old pal, Joe Garden. Joe, I met when I first started becoming pals with the people over at The Onion. This is pretty early on in Stuff You Should Know. I believe it was Joe Randazzo that reached out initially, said, "Hey, I'm the editor-in-chief of The Onion. We like what you guys do. Next time we're in New York, come by and see us." And we did. Josh and I went to The Onion, and it's a publication I had always loved and admired. Just some of the best writing, the best satire, really, that there is, came from The Onion in that era, in my opinion. And I went by, and I met Joe there. And Joe was just one of these guys who, like, was immediately friendly and just super nice and just a character. Joe's one of those guys where – like they truly broke the mold. He's one of the great oddballs I've ever known. And I say that in such an endearing way. Love me some Joe Garden. And he was coming back up from being in Florida on a road trip. And we had been in touch. And he was like, "Hey, dude, I can stop by the studio if you want to talk about the horror movie Suspiria." And I said, "Sure, man, come on up. It'd be great to see you." And we did just that. And it's the first time I had seen Suspiria. The Italian giallo horror classic from Argento. If you haven't seen this movie, boy, oh boy, hang on to your hats. I had long, I was about to say avoided it. I didn't avoid it because I wanted to see it. But I had long wanted to see it, but never got around to it until Joe forced me to watch it. And it is something else, not for the faint of heart. Kind of corny in some parts because of what it is, but also deeply disturbing and horrific and beautiful. And the music is so great. And it's just, it's one of these cult classics that you got to check out. And Joe has a lot of love for the film, a lot of love for the genre. So if you are a horror film fan, especially a fan of Italian giallo horror movies of that era, then you're going to really enjoy this. And I think you're also going to like hearing about The Onion and Joe's time there. If you're a fan of comedy writing, this is a good one to listen to. So here we go, everyone, with Joe Garden on Suspiria.
Have you tried the DJ trick of licking it to make sure it's connecting right?
Is that a thing?
Well, it's for a thing for when you're putting if you're using a new turntable at a bar you've never been to, you always have to bring your own cartridges because, like, cartridges disappear at people's. So uh-huh. You bring your cartridges. You lick it to make sure it makes all the contacts with it.
Oh, wow.
So that was, you know, I didn't do much of it, but I did enough of it to know that trick.
Thing X.
Yeah, Thing X just kind of fell apart, and it was like – and then it – or there was like a – turned into Adult Swim where we didn't have – you know, we were supposed to find our own voice, and instead we were trying to find a voice of – I don't know what kind of voice we were trying to find. It was like we were trying to please Mike Lazzo, who was impossible to please.
Right.
So, and then at that point, I was like, and then I had moved into an apartment where I had a really sweet deal.
Yeah.
Where it was like it was like every, I think it was like $900 a month I was paying for like a full.
And that was in New York?
Yeah.
Or in Brooklyn?
In Greenpoint.
Mm-hmm. Which is so cheap.
Yeah, I know. And it was like, it was definitely the apartment I needed when I needed it. But my landlord died, and his niece is like, "Well, you know, we're going to sell the building."
Yeah.
And I'm like, "Okay, well, that's fine. But, you know, I have a 2-year lease that I just signed right before he died. So you're going to have to buy me out." And so I gave them a price, and they're like, "Well, that seems awful high." I was like,
Right.
And I kept on being like, "Oh my God, she's right. It does seem awful high." But the advice people gave me was like, "You know what? Don't bid against yourself. Like, you, this is your, like, it's up to them to make a counteroffer. It's not
right.
It's not your job to do that." And
right.
So they never did, and I got what I asked for. So I took the money and moved up to upstate New York.
Right.
So, yeah. So it's like, it's nice. It's like I live right outside of Woodstock.
Oh, man. Have you been by Big Pink?
I haven't yet. It's funny because it's like
First thing I think about.
Yeah, well, it's like, and I have been, you know, I have been down the little lonely stretch of road that Bob Dylan was on when he crashed his motorcycle. By his agents. But I haven't been by Big Pink yet. I don't know why I haven't.
I'm a band nut and also Dylan nut. So, mm-hmm. yeah, I would like – I almost went to see, you know, Levon's place when mm-hmm. he was alive and went to one of the rambles there and never got to. And then he passed away and I always thought there would have been time. And so I was just so upset.
Yeah. It's like – it's one of those things like everybody has in Woodstock has so much affection for him. And everybody talks about him like – they're on a first name basis, which is a weird thing. It's you know, it's nice to be a part of the community like that.
And it's still that area is still very much artist sort of centric, right?
Yeah, very much so. Kingston is nearby. It's uh-huh. like it's about, you know, a 15-minute drive from Woodstock,
right?
And that's also becoming a lot of. Well, I can't say a lot, but, you know, a friend of mine is – her name is Carolina Johnson. She's a mm-hmm. New Yorker cartoonist. She lives up there now.
Oh, nice.
A few other musicians that I know – like I know a few musicians up there that are – some currently – you know, they're all currently recording actually. And then, yeah, so it's like it's still like
That's
it's
great.
Still pretty vibrant. It's still, you know, still people are moving up there, and Kingston especially is like – sort of becoming the cool little spot. Yeah.
Now, how long were you at The Onion?
God, I was there for 19 years. I mean, I was there full time for 8 and then like as a contributing writer and you know, for, you know, 11 before that. So.
Well, but you're from Wisconsin, right?
Yeah.
Okay. Is that where you worked for them initially or no?
Yeah, I lucked into it. I mean, I was when the first year of The Onion was also my first year as a student in the University of Wisconsin.
Wow.
So I remember a friend of mine walked up to me. He's like, oh, look at this hot new thing. And he showed me a cartoon written, which I found out later was written by Scott Dickers, the former editor-in-chief.
Uh-huh.
And he showed me this cartoon. It's like the Freshman Universe, because I was a freshman at the time.
Right.
Like, ha, 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 that's you.
Yeah.
But I remember still that very distinctly, that first cover.
Wow.
The Monster of Lake Mendota, which uh-huh. was, you know, it was the famous Loch Ness Monster uh-huh. photo. And then, you know, I went on and didn't even think I would be able – it was sort of like a clubhouse that I thought I'd never be able to get into. And
right.
I met some of the people that worked there, and then finally one of them came up and was like, you're funny. You want to try writing for us? And I'm like, yeah, I would. That would be great.
So you joined up pretty soon after they launched then, a few years?
5 years, but it's like uh-huh. I was there before they were online.
Right.
I mean, it's one of those things where people are always like, one of the founding people from The Onion. And it's like, I don't like –
Not exactly, but close.
Yeah. It's like, well, relative to the whole endeavor, which is 30 years old
at this point. Yeah.
Yeah, they just had their 30th year last year. That's crazy.
Now – all right. So you write for The Onion there. You moved to New York for that job?
Yeah.
Okay.
I could never – I mean the thing about lucking into a job is that you're never really sure how to parlay that into other jobs.
Mm-hmm.
So – but when The Onion moved to New York, like I sort of said, you know, I have been doing this for such a long time and I've been, you know, getting paid very little as a writer – as a freelance writer for you, and I'd like to – go full time. And, you know, I've also created 2 recurring characters that you know, are pretty beloved.
You said I'd like to make a little money working full time for you.
Yeah, kind of. I mean, asserting myself has never been my strong point. It still isn't. Even though there are people like when people owe me money, I want to be like, hate to mention this, but I spent 8 hours doing some work for you.
Right, it's my fault.
Yeah, exactly. It's my fault that you owe me money. But can we take care of that sometime?
All right. So you go to New York. You're writing for The Onion.
Mm-hmm.
Is it still just a newspaper at this point, or is it online yet?
We had gone online in like 1998 or 97 or 98, I think, and it was. It just happened to be at the right place at the right time. It was uh-huh. like a perfect storm of, you know, we had been honing our, you know, it wasn't even content then. It was writing. We'd been honing our writing and honing what we were doing for years. And so by the time it actually went online, we had a finished product that was, you know, ready to roll.
Yeah.
And so people gravitated toward it pretty quickly. And, you know, we were – because we were one of the first, you know, parody, you know, satirical news sites. I almost said satirical. So that was – I mean, it was really fortunate on our part because we – if we had been a year later, I don't know if the same thing would have happened.
Right.
And if we had been earlier, which here's a little – I don't know. This has never been talked about in the Onion history, but it is a very true thing. When I started at the Onion, there were two print editions.
Mm-hmm.
There was the Madison edition, and then there was an edition that was printed in Champaign-Urbana, Illinois, at their campus. And the – I could say this because I wasn't – there's no – I have no confidentiality clause. I don't think anybody ever had a confidentiality clause there. But so this is like 1993.
Uh-huh.
Right after I started, the people that were running the Champaign-Urbana edition stopped paying their franchise fees. They didn't pay for like a couple months.
Uh-huh.
But they were running the content, running the paper. And then they also were working on their own online edition called The Melvin. Keep in mind, in 1993, an online anything meant that I think there's no – like there's no simple web browser. I think it was Gopher or something like that.
Oh, yeah.
Like,
who knows?
I can't even remember. Like the early – the internet in the early days was just like I have no idea how to find any of this stuff that's supposedly – you know,
lives here.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It was like one step up from the BBSs of the 80s.
Right.
And, of the 80s and 90s. But – so they started this thing called The Melvin, and they were just like trying to float it out there. And I remember us all clustered around the one computer in the office that was connected to the internet and watching it download piece by piece. It was sitting there for 5 minutes, and then it was like it looked exactly like The Onion, same format, same like same joke structures, same font even. And they called the lawyer. The lawyer put a cease and desist on it, and another 4 or 5 years passed before we actually went online. By that time, you know, you could, and it was an easier. So, yeah, that was an interesting. It was interesting though watching it, you know, because having sort of toiled in semi-obscurity to, you know, in Madison, then we expanded to Milwaukee, then we expanded to Chicago, then we expanded to Minneapolis, and then we're online, and people are like talking about us, and you know, click and clack, the Tappet brothers are reading an article of the Onion's on their on the air, and I was so like it was just suddenly it's just like so flattering. It's just like, oh my gosh, we made it.
Yeah.
Even though we were still getting paid pretty poorly, but
it was such a fun vibe. Like when I visited a couple of times, you know, and it just feels like those were sort of the salad days of the Onion, and everyone was like awesome, and all the writers and. I mean, you just had like rock stars on staff.
There were – I mean, there really were. It's funny because like there were a core of – there were people that definitely knew that they could sort of turn their experience at The Onion into a writing career.
Yeah.
Into writing comedy for
it's like an incubator almost.
Yeah. Like Dan Weber was one of the early editors. Mm-hmm. He's like – you know, he's – went on to be one of the first writers at Futurama and is like now on The Simpsons. Dan Guterman, who is later, but he's like, you know, he worked on – oh, shoot. What did he – he worked on Rick and Morty and some other stuff, Community. Carol Kolb is at Brooklyn, you know, who was amazing. She was like such a rock at that place. Like I can't emphasize how her sensibility was just like – she was great at like – reining in a bunch of like lunkheads that would just like would just as soon like sleep under their desk for most of the day and like getting work like getting quality work and banging it into shape. And you know, she was a fantastic editor. And you know, and Rob Siegel who is now doing The Wrestler, or he wrote The Wrestler, he wrote and directed Big Fan.
Wow.
He wrote a few other things.
Oh, that's right, you were in Big Fan.
I had a brief
That's right. That was a good movie.
It was a good movie. That's my CV should just include the phrase "did not ruin Big Fan." I wasn't great at it, but I was okay.
You were good.
Thank you.
Yeah.
If you haven't seen it, it's starring Patton Oswalt, and it's great. Oh, and who else?
Well, Randazzo, of course.
Yeah, and Joe Randazzo, who's
still writing.
Yeah, still writing, and he's I think he was at midnight at midnight.
And
that feels weird to say.
Todd Hanson, right?
Todd Hanson and I have Todd is great. It's like, if you haven't, can I suggest a podcast that's not on the Stuff You Should Know Network?
Joe, come on.
I know.
Of course you can. boats rise.
Listen to Todd Hansen on the Mark Maron podcast.
Oh, he did one of those?
He did one of those, and he talks very, it's like, it's divided into two halves. The first half is talking about The Onion, and the second half is talking about his very real struggle with depression, which culminated in a suicide attempt.
Oh, man.
And it's really honest and moving and, you know, just – and he's a really wonderful guy.
Yeah.
In fact, the last time we hung out in – he came up – we did – he and I have done some writing workshops for Bard College, which is right by, you know, pretty close to me.
Sure.
And they have the Bardvark, it's called. they have Brad Comedy, and they do the Bardvark, and it's like their humor organization. So we've gone in there and done a couple of writing workshops with them.
Uh-huh.
And the last time he came up for that, we sat down and watched Mad Max. Me for the second time, him for the 18th. Not Mad Max. It was Fury Road. Me for the second time, him for the 18th time. And watching a movie with Todd Hansen is a great experience because he's just like – it doesn't matter how many times he's seen it. He's one of those kids. He's just like – will just be like vibrating with excitement.
Right.
He'll be like, oh, he'll point out things you might have missed.
Yeah, that's great.
Yeah, he's really great. And it's just like there's so many other great people that have worked there. And
it was just such a like – I mean the vibe was great, but it just felt like – it felt like what it must have been like to be like the Lampoon in the 70s and 80s, I feel like.
Yeah, I think so, except for I think – well, there's another core – like there's the people that moved on and then there's the people that just like – never knew, like, because, like me, for example, who lucked in and just was like, I didn't know how to, you know, I didn't know how to make it anything besides, you know, working it. I mean, this is going to sound like I'm being falsely modest, but it's just like, I just don't know where my strengths are as a writer. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I have a hard time. If something doesn't come easily to me, I'm just like, I get really like, well, I don't know what to do now. It's like, do I go back and or do I give up? And
right.
Like, obviously, the answer usually is yes. so, and it's, you know, which is not – it's a definitely a failing that I understand in myself, and I'm trying to rectify that with other things I'm working on.
Yeah?
Yeah. Well, right now – I mean, I haven't been
– What are you working on?
Well
– like, how are you scratching that creative itch? Because, like, I've known you for a while. You were at The Onion, and then when The Onion moved, there was a – it was a huge deal.
Oh God!
To move from New York, and everyone was faced with that big decision. Like, am I done with this amazing thing that we've all like? This big family is getting broken up.
Mm-hmm.
I'm sure it was traumatic as hell.
Yeah, it was definitely traumatic as hell.
And you kind of dropped out and went to upstate New York.
I did. You know, we did 2 years. You know, I continued working with Joe Randazzo and Chris Karwowski and
sure
you know,
with Thing X.
Yeah, with Thing X, which then it was AdultSwim.com, which then was nothing.
Uh-huh.
And I just was like, I don't know what to, you know, I don't know where I'm going to go at this point. So I moved upstate. I wrote a couple, you know, freelance pieces here and there.
Uh-huh.
And then one of the things I have always done is I always was kind of, I don't know if you remember from visiting The Onion, I used to run a bodega called Joe's Cold Beverages.
Dude, I totally remember. And I thought that was hysterical and awesome. Like you always... And following you on Facebook all these years, you're always sort of looking for that side hustle. I feel like selling shit and you had a robust eBay thing going for a while.
And I still do. And that's what I've mostly concentrated on. I mean, I'm still doing other creative stuff. I've been moving into like – and here's the thing. I'm going to go on a little mini rant.
Okay.
Because I call my business like Secondhand Joe's.
Uh-huh.
I don't want to use the word vintage because for me the word vintage is just bereft of meaning.
Sure.
It's just a bullshit term that people use to sell transformers that were like in a plastic box for 10 years.
Yeah.
You know, it's like if you talk about antiques have like there is a legal definition for antiques.
Mm-hmm.
It is – I mean I think maybe legal is not the quite –
But it's a certain number of years, right?
Yeah, 100 years old, and it's an antique. But if it's vintage, it just means somebody else has owned it before most of the time.
Right.
Yeah, and so like people when they ask, like, well, is this vintage? It's like, I don't know. Somebody else owned it, so sure, it's vintage. Why not? Fuck it. I don't care. It's vintage.
Yeah.
But I do that, and so I find all kinds – like I think part of the itch that gets scratched for me is like not only reselling things but like finding just – interesting things. Mm-hmm. Like there are things that I can find that will, you know, that I know that I can turn around for a profit, and it's just like, eh, you know, that's neither here nor there. Just like I do it, and mm-hmm. I'm just like, because I need to pay a mortgage, and I need have dogs to feed, and you know, my wife is, you know, she's working in a pharmacy and you know, part time at a pharmacy, mm-hmm. and then the rest of the time she's cartooning. So we're not like
she's a cartoonist.
Yeah, she is.
Awesome.
She mostly does it online, and she's had one published piece in an anthology called Dirty Diamonds.
Mm-hmm.
One second. Pardon me. I knew I shouldn't have had a cola.
That's all right. Well, and also I want to say, like, when I say you dropped out, that was not – I'm not, like, trying to be derogatory. Like,
oh, no.
You got a great new wife, and you bought a house that you were renovating. You got dogs, and, like, that's – out that bucolic sort of lifestyle is so appealing to me, so I totally get it.
Yeah. It's nice. I just like, yeah. I can't deny that it's been a fantastic experience, just like sort of being able to rediscover myself.
Sure.
And, you know, the selling stuff, the secondhand sales are just fun because like I get to it's like a treasure hunt. Uh-huh. Like you go to an auction and you're like, oh, this is interesting. And then yeah. you sort of like do a little bit of research. And like one thing I found was an auction I picked up for a pretty, well, I mean, who's going to, like, I don't think anybody who, well, maybe somebody would actually. So I'm not going to say how much I spent on it. but I got a really good price on it. Let's just say. And it was a box of what looked like manuscripts, you know, the uh-huh. kind that had the, what are those binders called? They're like script binders.
Yeah, yeah.
They're not,
yeah,
like,
I know
they're
what
not
you mean.
Brads, but they have the
– the long things?
Yes.
Yeah.
It was filled with those, about 18 to 20 of them. Mm-hmm. And I was like – I was kind of flipping through them. And I was like, what is this? I was like – I wasn't like a script, but it was all hand typed.
Mm-hmm.
And I found like a title page, and it was called The Comedian. And it turns out it was by this – it was a – monthly newsletter. These are bound editions. Each mm-hmm. each bound edition was a year's worth of monthly newsletters, and each month was 20 to 24 pages of original jokes and gags that this guy Billy Glaston would write, and he would sell sell mimeographs of them for $2 a piece. And if you were a stand-up comedian comedian on the circuit,
uh-huh.
you could actually like buy this and use that material, which is funny because like now comedians are very proprietary about their their material, and it's like, you know, the idea that somebody's actually just writing jokes that anybody can use if they subscribe to the newsletter is uh-huh. so strange.
What era was this?
Like 50s through the early 70s.
Wow.
And he was actually a vaudeville guy back in the day, like back in the I think he has a novelty song or two.
Uh-huh.
If you look him up online, like you can find the sheet music for one of his novelty songs. He wrote jokes for like Bob Hope and Johnny Carson
wow.
and Flip Wilson. So he was a professional. Uh-huh. He was actually making a go of it. And these are just like – it's amazing. It's just like – there's also
– Now, where do you find that?
That was at an auction.
Okay.
And I was like everybody just started passing it by and like nobody was really interested. And mm-hmm. I was like, you know – And of course, as a comedy,
sure.
as a comedy nerd, I was just like this. It felt like finding a Rosetta
yeah,
Stone of some sort.
Right.
Like even though it was like nobody may have known who he was,
right?
It was still like the idea of like somebody churning out 20 to 24 pages of jokes every month.
Yeah,
and like single spaced. It's uh-huh. not like, you know, he didn't skimp. So
wow.
And that was like, well, the downside is that there's also a minstrel show script in there.
Sure.
And you're just like, ugh.
Right.
I can't see it. I'm just looking at this. I was like, I don't even know what to do with this.
Right.
Like, there's not like, I can't sell this because, you know, if somebody was like collecting Black Americana or like it was, that would be one thing. But it's like,
right.
if you sell something like that online, you don't know if it's going to go to somebody who's just like whose interest is in racism is academic or prurient and, you know, visceral.
Right. And look at all my collection of Nazi China I have as well.
Yeah, exactly. This will go perfectly with my mammy figure collection and my swastika pens.
Were you able to sell that stuff though?
I sold a few. I gave some away as gifts.
Oh, that's cool.
And, you know, I've definitely made my money back on it, and I have plenty more just to, like, hang on to or sell when the time is right. And so
yeah.
It's a good – yeah. So stuff like that. It's like where you just – that's what I like about doing this is like you can find amazing yeah. things that you just didn't even know existed. Although right now the downside is I have a hair stitching machine that I bought.
oh my God.
which can use either human hair or like fake hair.
For, stitch it into what?
Wigs or doll heads. So oh. it's a funny – I mean that's the thing where I was just like I know that I could be sitting on this for a very long time. But uh-huh. there's that part of me that's like this is just so weird. I've got to fucking have this.
Yeah, yeah. Sure. Now, you also, I remember seeing through social media, you ran into Hogan Camp.
I did. Right when I moved up to, you know, I was like, I had just moved upstate and, you know, left all, I live in Saugerties, like between Saugerties and Woodstock. Saugerties is mm-hmm. the home of Big Pink. Woodstock is where Bob Dylan lived.
Right.
We were just talking about that.
Sure.
But, and Kingston is pretty close by. And you know, I moved upstate and I was like, God, Jesus, did I make the right choice? Like I
right.
left my social – like I have some friends up here but I've left most of my social
yeah.
Network behind in New York and it's like that, what am I going to do? Like am I going to be able to make it with freelance writing and uh-huh. what's going to happen up here? And so I just went to – like I went to the Salvation Army in Kingston and was just kind of bopping around and I – the cashier's talking to this woman. I'm getting ready to check out, and the cashier's talking to this woman, and this guy is talking. He's talking to the cashier, and he's got like a Barbie doll strung around his neck. I was like, you know, whatever.
Sure.
And then he's like, yeah, there are these foreign women that were taking my picture. They were all talking to me. And I'm just like, what the hell is going on here? I just couldn't figure out what it was. And then he said something. He was talking a little bit, and finally it clicked for me. I just sort of jumped into the conversation. I was like, "Wait, Marwin Call?" And he's like, "Yeah." I was like, "Can I get a picture with you?" And I was just so
yeah.
like, and for me that was just like, "Oh, I've made the right decision because
right.
I'm
this in random this Salvation Army."
Yeah, in the Salvation Army, and I run into this like, you know, amazing visionary photographer,
yeah.
dioramist. He's a photographer, I guess a dioramist.
Yeah, sure.
But yeah, it's like, and I was like, oh, I made the right choice because
yeah.
This seems like it's where I belong.
That's pretty cool.
Yeah, it was great. And so, you know, and it's just been it's been pretty fantastic. I mean, close enough, you know, about 100 miles north of New York City, so.
You ever go in?
Yeah, I go less and less.
Yeah. It's something to be said for living out in the country.
Oh, yeah, absolutely. I mean, the food, you know, you don't have the wide variety of food.
Right.
But, you know, I eat a lot healthier because I cook a lot more.
Yeah.
And it's also, you know, I really like it. Oh, we also – the best part about it is we have – oh, well, I'm just going to detour a little bit. When I was looking at houses, the realtor – I was like, oh, what about that house? It's like a split level. It was kind of beat up.
Mm-hmm.
We looked at it online. We drive out, and as we're pulling in, she's like, oh, the guy that lives over there has a record sale like a couple times a year. He like rents a tent, and it's a big deal. Like he has like tables and tables and tables of records.
Uh-huh.
I'm like, oh, you don't say.
Right, right.
And then
of the feather.
Yeah, and then we're walking around, and I go in the backyard, and I see that there's a functional, although wobbly, merry-go-round. Like full-size merry-go-round
wow.
in the backyard. And I'm just like, well, that's for me. yeah, and it's great.
Was that the house?
Yeah, that's the house.
Do you still have the merry-go-round?
I would still have the merry-go-round.
Oh, my God.
I mean, what am I going to do? Am I going to get rid of a merry-go-round? No.
That means you're officially dead inside. Take this merry-go-round. Get it out of here.
Get this merry-go-round and throw it into that. Throw it into the hole with all the Legos in it.
Right.
I don't want to see those ever again.
Well, let's jump back some to your growing up days.
Okay.
Because, you know, we always like to talk about the movies and influence and, like, what was Joe Garden as a kid like? What were you watching? What were you into?
I grew up in the 70s. I think I'm a year older than you.
I was 71.
70.
Okay.
But March
sure.
also, so.
Yeah, when's your birthday?
March 10th.
All right.
And
yeah.
yours is March.
Just a few days ago, 15th.
Oh. Holy
happy
holy.
Birthday.
Happy birthday to you,
yes,
too.
Sir.
I can't believe I forgot to wish you a happy
birthday.
That's
all right. 48 and 49 then,
yeah.
right?
Yeah, as I'm getting closer to 50, it's putting a lot of stuff in perspective.
Sure.
Yeah, but when I was growing up, I was born in Chicago, mm-hmm. and we moved when I was 3 years old. We moved from Chicago to a small town in southwest Wisconsin called Richland Center.
Mm-hmm.
And when I say we moved to that town, I mean we moved to a house 7 miles outside of that town.
Right.
So we were in the middle of nowhere. We were able to walk in the middle of the road for like a mile without having to be having to worry about getting hit by a car.
It's kind of great.
Yeah. I love it.
Yeah.
It's nice. It's funny when I was in high school. I was like, I can't wait to get out of here.
Yeah,
and
man.
Now I go back. I'm just like, I don't want to leave. This is so fantastic.
Yeah. Similar here.
We weren't really close to a movie theater, but I was always – there was a few things I was always super into, which was like, you know, the CBS movie of the week.
Mm-hmm.
And the thing that really – I was thinking about this. Like the thing I really loved was James Bond movies when I was a kid. I would always just sit there and just like wait for the – you know, wait for James Bond movies to come up. And then at some point I also started to get really interested. I think I just checked out some books at the library mm-hmm. that had – like they were sort of like – you know the like those famous Monsters of the Filmland and stuff like that, the magazines that would have like pictures of horror movies in there.
Uh-huh.
This is like the hardcover edition version of that. It wasn't like Famous Monsters of the Filmland, but it was like horror movie moments or whatever.
Yeah.
And it's just like black and white pictures, still pictures from horror movies.
Uh-huh.
And I would just remember like – flipping through it, like checking it out and like flipping through it. And I just remember like some really – like there's one image that I still remember. I don't know what the movie was. And
uh-huh.
I don't know – I can't – because I can't remember the title of the book, I can't figure it out.
Right.
But it was a picture of a woman, like just a picture like shoulders up, her head at an angle. She had an axe in her head and there was like blood all over except for immediately around the wound.
Right.
So it was like – which was weird. But I was like so terrified and fascinated by that picture.
Yeah.
And so I started like – I was like, I'm going to start watching horror movies.
How old are you at this point?
I was probably like 8 to 10 uh-huh. around there. And there's two important horror movie things. There was – sort of the precursor to Mystery Science Theater 3000. I mean, that's not fair because everybody had this. I want to make it seem like it's unique to Madison. But I think everybody had like a horror movie host.
Uh-huh.
And in Madison, Wisconsin, which is where the networks would broadcast from, they had a thing called Ferdy's Inferno
uh-huh.
where they'd have like – they'd show – Friday nights they'd show a horror movie at like – I think it was like 11 o'clock or mm-hmm. after the nightly news. And, you know, I'd try my hardest to stay up to watch whatever.
Right.
The only one I remember watching was one called The Monolith Monsters, which were just basically like carbon stalactites that would like – and people like – you know, it was black and white science fiction-y horror and like people running away. And I was like, this is – it's not that great, but I still – still I feel like getting away with something. And then I remember probably I was like 10 or 11 and I remember staying up to watch the public television broadcast of the Cabinet of Dr. Caligari.
Mm, right.
Which I didn't know what to expect, but it was black and – you know, I remember – fortunately, it was a black and white movie because I remember watching it on a tiny black and white TV set at my mom's house and just being like engrossed by this thing. And waking up the next morning being like, Mom, what's a somnambulist?
Uh-huh.
So – yeah, so that was it. That was like, you know, and then we had a movie theater in town, so we'd go and watch, you know, I remember, you know, we went to see The Rescuers, for example, with my dad. My parents divorced when I was 5, so my dad took us to see The Rescuers
uh-huh.
at one point, which came out in 77.
Seems about right, yeah.
And
I remember.
Then, we told my mom later, I was like, oh, we'd like to see The Rescuers. They're like, have you seen it? We're like, oh, no.
Just you could go again?
Yeah. And so we went and we were just like, we gave ourselves away because we started singing along with, the songs. R-A-S-C-U-E. So, yeah. But then I also remember going to see Moonraker.
Yeah, man, me too.
Yeah. And it's like, and it seemed like the best thing in the world. And now you look back at it, you're like, oh.
Does not age well. Still kind of fun to watch.
Yeah.
For sure. But I remember at the time Moonraker was like, I mean, the most advanced, you know, futuristic thing I had ever seen.
You had a space shuttle. You had James Bond. You had Jaws. I mean, it was all like it was everything like a 10-year-old kid could ask for.
And if you were a Bond fan, it was like, it really kind of rocked your world to see him in that context mm-hmm. of like space and stuff like that.
Yeah. And it's like, did they need to do it like that? Probably they could have done it a little bit more cleanly without having to go into space. But, you know, I think Star Wars by that time had, you know, made a massive impact. So they're like, we got to take James Bond to space.
I guess that was it, huh?
Yeah. You know, it's funny how just the ripple effect that Star Wars had on all these other movies.
And
You know.
Now, were you into that? Were you into sci-fi and stuff?
Oh, yeah. I loved – I mean, I was such a huge – like, I saw Star Wars. I think it theatrically – I mean, this is interesting, too, because, like, it's before, you know, Star Wars didn't air – you know, I don't think they ever aired it on network TV. And
yeah.
We didn't have cable, and I don't even know if they did run it on cable. And if you were lucky to have a CED or Laserdisc player back in the 80s,
yeah,
you could maybe see it. But there was – you know, so I saw it in the theater, Star Wars 7 times, Empire Strikes Back 5 times, Return of the Jedi 3 times.
I was kind of right there with you.
Mm-hmm.
Like, I mean, Star Wars came out when I was 6, you were 7. I had an older brother. And so we were in there a lot. Like, it was one of those deals where my parents were like, you want to go see this movie, like, for the 5th time? And we were like, yeah, just drop us off, you know?
Yeah. Why are you even asking this question?
Just could not get enough of it.
Yeah. And it's – do you remember the skeletons?
No.
Because there were when Luke comes back to the farm and he sees all the smoking wreckage.
Yes.
In some cuts, in early cuts, you could see the skeletons of Uncle
Owen and Aunt Beru.
Yes. You can see their skeletons kind of smoldering.
Uh-huh.
And there were even trading cards which had that image on it. And then I think they cut it away.
I don't remember seeing it.
Yeah. I'm pretty sure they cut it away. They cut it out after a short period of time. So it's like, you know.
Yeah.
And if that's the case, you know, George Lucas was always like.
Right.
Always like quick to correct what he perceived as his mistakes.
Yeah. You know what, man? That's funny you mentioned that because. Not too long ago, I saw someone make reference to the skeletons, and this was like within 6 months ago,
mm-hmm.
and I was like, I don't remember seeing any skeletons, and they were talking about what a hardcore image that was, and I was like, I don't even know what they're talking about.
Yeah.
And then I went and saw, and it was there, and I'm like, I surely would have remembered that. So was it not in there?
It was in there, and then I think it was in there, and then they cut it out.
Huh.
And was it in a later – did you go back and watch it?
I mean, of course I watched the re-release,
yeah,
with it, you know, sort of messed with it.
And it is in the re-release? Because
think so.
Okay.
I know there's probably Star Wars fans that know the exact answer.
Well, that's the thing. It's like I'm almost hesitant to talk about Star Wars because you're just like –
go on record.
There are people like tearing their hair out listening to this. You fools!
Yeah. All I know is I don't remember seeing those skeletons. And then when I saw it more recently in fact, when I had Taron Killiam on and he chose Star Wars – that's when it kind of came up, and I was like, wait a minute. I totally don't remember seeing the scene,
mm-hmm.
like, played out like that.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
Interesting.
I have a very distinct memory of that, and I'm just trying to remember if I'm – yeah, it's funny because, like, I mean, there's also the part of me that wonders if I saw the card and then just sort of inserted the card into this –
I had those cards, too.
All the, like, yeah. Starting with the blue, then the red, then the – oh, my gosh.
My brother, I think, still has some of the old toys, but we never – I mean, we played with them like crazy. They're all beat up. I didn't even know that collecting those things was a thing and that you're not supposed to open them. So we just beat them up. But I do still have the calendar.
Oh, wow.
Which is kind of fun.
Mm-hmm.
And then my brother, I think, kind of hung on to some of the other stuff. But well,
the calendar is great because it's like having a poster, Star Wars poster, but it's 12 Star Wars posters,
that's
one
right.
for every month. it's interesting because like that's another issue I have with the whole vintage thing is like everything's got to be in perfect shape and it's like, oh, this is still mint on card. It's like, man, I think people. I mean, I believe things are made to be played with. You know, I found like some Ricardo was one of the characters on Pee-wee's Playhouse.
Mm-hmm.
He was the soccer player.
Yeah, yeah.
And so I got a couple of those. I found them at a flea market. They were, you know, on the card and I gave one away and I, you know, opened the other one and just put them on my shelf. It's like
and played with it.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, if there's one thing that's really makes a 45-year-old attractive to women, it's playing with action figures.
Now, when did you start writing and getting into comedy writing and stuff?
I would like to think I was a creative kid. Uh-huh. The way I really started writing originally is because, like, I thought I was going to be – I didn't know what I wanted to do when I was – like, once I graduated. I just knew I wanted to go to the University of Wisconsin-Madison.
Right.
And I wanted to – maybe – I was, like, a big music person, so I was like, maybe I'll be in a band or something.
Uh-huh.
And it turns out I don't have the patience to to play music, to learn music, or to practice music. So,
what was your major?
I was undeclared for the entire entirety until
can
I
you
dropped
do that?
Out.
Oh, okay. So you didn't graduate?
Yeah, I didn't graduate.
Gotcha.
But I started. I was working in a liquor store called Badger Liquor on State Street, which is between sort of equidistant between the state capitol and the university.
Mm-hmm.
So it was like a really heavily trafficked area in Madison. And I would make – I started making signs for the – for the store.
Mm-hmm.
And I started – first they were straight, and then they'd have like little weird doodles on them. And then they'd just start having text, a little bit of text. Then it would have a little bit more text. And then it would be like text heavy, like, a 200-word essay on driving through La Crosse and, where the king – where old-style beer was made. And then it was like with a little product at the bottom. And that's how –
Wow.
People from The Onion found me is because I
really
have these signs in the
liquor store.
Store
posters.
Yeah, the signs like would be outside, and it was just like,
that's pretty cool, man.
It was lucky. It was really, it was fortunate.
I bet there are people like there's probably like two people listening to this. They're like, holy shit, that was that's who that was.
Well, there was a bunch of us afterwards that like because I kind of like started it, and then you know, my friend Matt Quiggle, who's like I haven't been in touch with him for a long time. So if you're listening, Matt, I apologize. I'll call. but he would made some funny ones, and then two other people after us, like named Rick and Anders, they were making signs, and they actually got they somehow managed to get a job writing ad copy for J&B Scotch.
Oh, wow.
Based on their primitive signs and primitive painted signs. And they asked them, oh, just bring that same aesthetic with us.
Uh-huh.
And I don't think it really sold a lot of scotch, but it gave them, it paid them for a while. So
right.
That was the important thing.
Interesting.
So it was good. It was like, it was good to get like to feel, put something out there creatively and mm-hmm. to get feedback from it. And it was interesting. I learned, fortunately at the time I was at The Onion, the stakes were really low. So I didn't have to, I wasn't as polished as
right.
I would have to be now if I was to start writing at The Onion.
Uh-huh.
So, I was able to learn a lot about and also I worked with Stephen Thompson, who was like, he was the editor of the AV Club at the time and the copy editor. And he sort of like, drummed a lot of simple grammatical stuff into my head that I
right.
just somehow – that I knew or I'd learned but I'd forgotten. And uh-huh. he's like, don't do this. Don't do this. Don't do this. And so that was – I owe a lot to him for that.
Sure. Somewhere in my iCloud, I have a photo that I took at the – when I – because when I went and visited you guys at The Onion, it was a very big deal for me. Like it was early on in Stuff You Should Know.
Mm-hmm.
And I think it was either you or Randazzo that reached out initially. And I was such a fan, and it was like – I was like, oh, my God. Like I felt like I was going to Mecca and just to go to that office and meeting you and Baratunde and, mm-hmm. and Joe and Carol and everyone and Todd. And I remember just being in the pitch room because all I ever wanted to do was be in a writer's room.
Mm-hmm.
And I just was so – it was just so fucking cool to me. And like this is where it all happens. The nerve center of like some of the best comedy writing out there. And then I look at I think it was on the wall, but there was a list of, I think, words.
The no-no words?
Yeah, that yeah. you weren't allowed to use. Was it in a headline?
Yeah,
like you
much.
Weren't allowed to use them in a headline?
And there was topics, there were things that were just like, I think, and I
it
started
was so, it. Just reading that was fucking hysterical. It was so good.
Because it was great, because it was the thing that was like, I mean, it was kind of conceited of me to start that list in the first place.
Oh, was that you?
Yeah, I started it, and I was like, so there would be things like William Shatner. No William Shatner jokes.
Yeah.
Because
it was kind of like the obvious things, and it was good. I mean, it was like kind of how to write smart satire was don't lean on this shit.
Yeah, exactly. Like there's things you should, you know, and now I shouldn't do that. But now I still kind of like I carry that with me about a lot of things, you know, if I look online and like I see people tweeting like things like I see what you did there. And it just like makes my
right.
It just makes my, you know, well, I have these sort of fins on the back on the side of my face that sort of expand to make my face look bigger, so I'm a little more aggressive. They stand out immediately.
Like that was a velociraptor.
Yeah, exactly.
Oh man.
So yeah, it's a.
I didn't know that was your list. Or I'm sure everyone contributed.
Everybody contributed once it started. And then some people are like, there shouldn't be a no-no words list. And the other people are like, no, there absolutely should be a no-no words list.
Yeah.
It was like, you know, as with everything in The Onion, everything was divisive.
Yeah. So. Well, that breeds good comedy. I'm sure that writer's room is probably brutal.
It was pretty brutal. And I think it was brutal and I, you know, but it resulted in some great comedy.
Like the business of taking comedy seriously is kind of every writer's room. And I don't know if a lot of people that have never done that realize that.
Mm-hmm.
It's not like – I mean, sure, you guys have fun and stuff, but – those writer's room sessions are not just like everyone sitting around laughing and patting each other on the back about how funny they are.
Yeah.
It's tough stuff.
Yeah. It's people being like, you know, shooting each other's stuff down.
Yeah.
And, you know, trying not to be personal about it. But, you know, there are jokes that I – like one of my favorite jokes that I always remember – it never ran in The Onion because it got shot down. But it's like it was always one of my favorite jokes, and it was by Chris Karwowski, who is a – he produces – right now he's in L.A. and doing some freelance writing there. And he produces the Trap Set, which is a podcast about drummers.
Cool.
It's great. But anyway, so he pitched this joke, which was – okay, I'm going to see if I can – I have to do it exactly right because it's all in the wording. It's the film Saw, how to indicate to others that you have viewed it. Because it's just like – it was just like a very convoluted way of trying to like sidestep saying, oh, I saw.
Right.
And that's the thing. It's like I love the way that was worded. And then
you got to think about that one. That's great.
Yeah. And then when the Saw 2 came out, I tried to revive it with the Saw 2, how to indicate the two others you have also viewed it. It still works. By Saw 3, I think people were tired of the franchise people weren't tired of the franchise because I think it went on for 7.
Oh,
I don't
God,
know.
Who knows?
Yeah, I dropped out after 1. I was like, I get it.
It's not my bag. So my favorite Onion headline ever is drugs win war on drugs.
Yes.
Who wrote that?
I don't know for sure. It seems like it would have been Todd Hanson or Carol Kolb, but
just so simple and like kind of perfect. And then I sent Randazzo one time that he I don't think I ever told him this, but it just like broke me. Like I sent him what I thought was a good headline and he said something about like, yeah, something about sending it to the workshop. They're back to the wood shop. And I was just devastated. I was like, oh my God. And I was like, because I didn't want to be the guy to even send him a headline, you know? And I was like, all right, I'm going to do it because I think it's good. And I put myself out there and he kind of shot it down. And I was like, oh, geez.
Well, for every headline meeting we had to come up with like 15 to 25 headlines.
I know,
and
man.
And of all of those, like you were lucky if like 1% of your work got into the paper. So.
Yeah. I didn't have that thick skin that you guys had to develop.
Yeah. And it's hard.
Sure.
It's like it's hard not to take it personally. It's like I'm
I know.
Not. I mean that's part of. I mean, I think because I knew everybody that I was working with, and I didn't feel like I had to prove anything. Well, I mean, that's not true. I've probably always felt like I had to prove every something, but I felt at least comfortable enough to accept when a joke wasn't working, and like, well, that's fine. It's just not going to go, and this is not. You know, maybe this isn't the time for that joke, or maybe that joke is just terrible.
Yeah.
Sometimes
it is not the right time.
Yeah.
And it could be another time.
Yeah. And I've got like a stack of notebooks, probably like a foot high, that are just filled with all my old headlines. A lot of the stuff.
Do something with that. Can you?
Yeah, I mean, maybe. I did take a lot of my old papers and I donated them to the University of Wisconsin.
Oh, cool.
Because I was like, including like original headline lists from the like the 9/11 issue, all the things that we pitched.
Oh, man, I remember that.
Woof.
Yeah, you guys handled that really well.
I mean, that was like I wish I could take any credit for it. I was there in the room, but I was just like I couldn't wrap my head around it.
Right.
But God bless him. Like, you know, Todd Hanson was the head writer at the time and Rob Siegel was the editor at the time. And they fucking blew the doors off of it. And
yeah.
They were like they knew exactly what they were doing.
Yep.
Because they're like we can make jokes, but it's like this is the tone has to be like not about the act itself, but
yeah.
It has to be about what the, you know, how the collective, you know, how the collective, how America is collectively dealing with it.
Yeah, yeah.
And I think that was like, that's why it worked. It wasn't like, you know, there were no tasteless jokes, there
yeah.
were no cheap jokes. It was just, well, you know, I guess the tastefulness of the hijackers' surprise to find themselves in hell story
right.
could be argued, but that was very cathartic. That was some real beautiful violence written by John Cruson, who I won't say that was his specialty, but that was definitely
– Oh, really?
Yeah. Just like it was a smorgasbord of just horrible acts being visited onto the terrorists.
Yeah, yeah.
But I think – yeah.
Now, did certain writers have certain specialties? They were like, oh, well, this has totally got to be a Hanson thing or like a Joe Garden thing.
Yeah. I mean, everybody had that. Like I had regular characters that I did, and I also would do like other – like I wasn't – it's great at the news format, but I think I was good at character voices. you know, Todd Hanson was good at like the sort of area man – the area man stories where it's like sort of –
I got to be an area man too, you know.
Yes, you did.
Which was one of my like great things ever.
Do you remember the headline or?
Oh, something about I was a deer hunter. I can't remember exactly what it was. And then I think it got dusted off and used again later on because mm-hmm. someone sent me another one.
Oh, that's great.
But yeah, I love it. I hope they keep finding me in the archives and putting my mugshot up there.
The thing is like it's a great picture because it's just like you. That's the thing that – the best thing about it is like about the photos is like they just had a knack for finding people and just being like,
yeah,
don't goof it up. Don't be jokey. Just like stares, like just look straight ahead.
Uh-huh.
Just like don't smile. Just sort of look like a, it's like, so that way everybody just sort of looked natural and normal.
Yeah. Yeah. That wasn't the joke.
Yeah. The joke shouldn't have been the picture.
Right.
Unless of course it was, particularly hilarious picture that was it was photo edited by our graphics guys Mike and Chad at the time.
Now, do you still read The Onion? Are you still, or did you just like kind of?
I think I haven't
separate.
Really. I separated and I go back every once in a while, but I don't really read it that much. I think it's like, maybe painful is the wrong word for it, but it's just like, I think I because I know how it's made. I just mm-hmm. you know. I did have an interesting experience last year. I went back for – there was a comedy – they had an Onion Comedy Festival in Chicago.
Mm-hmm.
And so I went for an Onion panel that was like a lot of the old – like a lot of the older school writers were
right.
there for it. And we – yeah, which was really interesting. But I went and sat in on the writer's room for their pitch meeting when
oh,
I was
wow.
there. There's a lot more writers, and it was just sort of strange. I just wanted to sit on the periphery and just sort of like see how it had
that
changed.
That must have been so weird.
It was really weird. Like I didn't know anybody really, and I was just like, you know, I was like, God, who are these kids?
It's almost like
so young.
You're watching someone make the movie version of of what happened with you guys.
Well, apparently there's been I've heard rumors that like. That two former Onion people have been collaborating on like a fictionalized version of The Onion. But I don't know what the narrative arc of that would be. It's like for me, it's just like, well, we were all kind of dumpy losers. And some of us went on to be less dumpy, less losers. And some of us remain dumpy losers. So, you know, it's not a great trajectory for a story. Not very propulsive.
Well, I don't want to knock anyone's work, but – after the big split when they moved back and all of my pals kind of were no longer there, I, with keen interest, sort of kept an eye on it for a little while. Mm-hmm. And it was not nearly as good. And then I just kind of quit.
I think
they found their legs a bit more lately from mm-hmm. some of the stuff I just see on like Facebook that someone will share, mm-hmm. Which is good. But I think it might have been rough going there early on.
I think it's hard to make the transition when so many people leave and like everybody has to, you know, it's definitely through no fault of the people that are there. They're all like the people who went were very talented. You know, Chad Nackers was like he had been – it's funny because he had been a graphics assistant. Then he became like – the head of graphics. No, he didn't even become the head of graphics. Then he became a writer. Then he became like the head writer, and now he's the editor-in-chief. Uh-huh. He's still with them. You know, Will Tracy was writing for – like went out as the editor to replace Joe Randazzo, and he, you know, went on to I think – gosh, where is he now? He might be at Colbert or The Daily Show.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to keep track of my former peers.
Right.
and then Seth Reese was working for Seth Meyers. And so they all like – it's like not – there was no want of talent. I think it's like – I think with the people that went – that made the move to Chicago, I think people just kind of got the wind knocked out of them. And it was mm-hmm. like it was hard to readjust to, you know, living in a new city, living, you know, with the business, you know, the business – side had been kept at more arm's length in the past.
Right.
And then because they were in another city, it was a lot easier to keep the business side at arm's length. So then when they moved, like this is speculation. Nobody's really said this as much to me. But, you know, when the business side is right there, it's like
it's a little weird.
Yeah, there's a discomfort, a bit of a discomfort to it that had to be overcome as well. There's still like good, there's still good talented people
sure.
coming, like going through there and like, and I see stuff that pops up on, you know, on Twitter and it makes me laugh.
Yeah.
So there's still like, and the thing is like, if I'm being honest, like there is no way in hell I would want to be writing onion jokes in this day and age.
Yeah.
I hate to say in this day and age, but like making jokes about Donald Trump is just like, you know, it's like the clown who cried, the Jerry Lewis, the Jerry Lewis movie about the Holocaust, where it's just like, it's like, he's like, I can make this work. And it's like, I don't want to, I mean, they're not, they have a more deft touch than Jerry Lewis, go figure. but it's still, I mean, after the election, I just got so angry that I don't think I would have been able to make jokes. I would have just been like,
nothing's funny about this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And it's really, really hard. Can I make a quick side track?
Sure.
Because you brought up like seeing stuff on Facebook.
Uh-huh.
So I've been off of Facebook since October. I didn't quit. I will probably shut down and delete the profile eventually. But so every time I hear a social studies, I'm just like, oh, man, I wish I could have gotten in on that.
Well, didn't you like text me some or something or email me some?
Well, there is one I texted you and it was about the tropes. And the trope I messaged you was like the person in some sort of like in a horror or a sci-fi movie. It's like, you're bleeding. And like they touch their nose and they're bleeding. Like, oh, and like it's either some sort of hypnotic effect or, you know, or psychic attack or something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
Total trope. but I jotted down some.
Oh, you got some tropes?
Not just tropes. Some other things I wanted to know if I could
get
in there.
Joe Garden just pulled out his little pocket notebook.
Social studies with movie on Movie Crush. Ba-ba! This is the Joe Garden edition. So the most memorable movie experience that did not involve the movie itself.
Uh-huh.
So,
oh, right, right. I love that you're catching up on this.
I'm such a big fan of the show. I'm such a regular listener that it's just like
thanks, man. You can text me your shit anytime.
But the most memorable experience was I was working at one of the side things I did is I worked at the Illinois State Fair at a worker-owned and operated food stand called Fred's for about 10 years.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, it was a pretty grueling, you know, it's a pretty grueling job. You'd work for 8 hours in the hot sun in a like 24-hour restaurant food stand.
Mm-hmm.
And so, you know, one of the things, one of the few, there's only so many times you can wander around the fairgrounds before you're like, let's get the hell out of here.
Yeah.
So my friend Wes and I decided we were going to go see, a movie.
Mm-hmm.
And so we went to the White Oaks Mall in Springfield, Illinois.
Yeah.
Went to see The Mystery Men.
Okay. Yeah.
And we were enjoying it, except for there were this group of about like maybe between like 5 and 10 teens
uh-huh.
sitting toward the back of the theater.
Yeah.
And they were like, they were laughing and like just talking, and they were like rolling M&Ms down the aisle.
Uh-huh.
Not that on the aisle, but like, so just like being intentionally disruptive.
Right.
And so I stepped out to use the bathroom. I came back and I was like sort of like sitting there by the back of the theater going, do I talk to these, like, you know, I mean, if you are a teenager listening to the show right now, you should know that even semi-confident people in their 20s, 30s, and 40s are terrified of you. So you can do whatever the hell you want. And I was like, oh, do I confront them? And just as I'm thinking this, like watching this group of teens, I see this guy come up to them. I don't hear exactly what he says, but he says something, and then he sprays them with a fire extinguisher. And
I'm just
like,
shit.
I'm just like, what the? And I was like,
And
then he like runs out the theater.
Uh-huh.
And I'm just like, okay. And I just sort of like walk back down, sit to my friend Wes, and then they turn off the movie because there's this cloud of powder like floating throughout the thing. It's like, oh yeah, we're going to have to refund your money, everybody.
And that was someone who was just fed up?
That was somebody who was just fed up like me.
Wow.
It was sort of like a Walking Tall scenario. He took the law into his own hands.
That's a good one, man.
Yeah, it was really unusual.
Yeah.
But I was kind of in shock afterwards. I would like to point out that I was not the one who did it.
Right.
And that's not for legal reasons. That's the absolute truth.
Uh-huh. That's a good one.
So here's another social studies. Here's my haiku hint for everybody.
All right.
Giovanni Ribisi has 7 syllables. So if you can...
Oh, that's pretty good.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Years ago, I was like making joke things, joke listings on eBay. And one of the things was like, I made this listing about how you would be able to buy an original haiku that would uplift the spirit.
Uh-huh.
And I was like, samples available on request. And somebody said, I'd like a sample. And so I sent him a haiku that was, I saw this movie, Giovanni Ribisi. What was I thinking? And he wrote back. He's like, sir, do you even know what a haiku is?
A haiku.
Yeah. I was like, I know it's supposed to be more pastoral, but that fits the format.
Oh, that's great. What else?
Well, the last one, this is interesting because like, this ties in the movie we're going to talk about.
Uh-huh.
And that is, there was, what movie do you regret seeing, like sitting through?
Mm.
And I remember listening to that. And I came up with my answer. I was like, oh, what movie do I regret seeing? I was like, took me about 15, 20 seconds. I was like, oh, yeah. Yeah, The New York Ripper. And I was like,
I don't even know that movie.
It's directed by Lucio Fulci, who directed Zombie.
Oh, okay.
He was like, it was a horror. It was a giallo, an Italian giallo movie. And it was just about a killer that would call, he was like, sort of talk like Donald Duck, and it was just like this just terribly misogynistic violence against women.
Uh-huh.
It was just like, it was just, you know, and I knew what I was getting into to an extent, but it's just like, it was just so horrible. Like, it was like dark, it was not dark in like a,
yeah,
it was like, it was just nihilistic.
Yeah.
And it's like, it was nihilistic and misogynistic, and at the end I was just like, I just feel like a bad person for having watched that.
Yeah.
And then like 20 seconds later, as I'm listening, you're like, oh, our own Robert Lamb has his answer. The New York Ripper. And I was just like, what the hell? How does that work? That there's like two of us that chose this like weird Italian.
Yeah.
And I wasn't even like, I honestly wasn't trying to go out of my way to be like, what kind of obscure, because like, who am I going to, except now years after the fact.
Right.
Make it public. But yeah, it's one of those things. I was just like, it left such a bad taste in my mouth.
Yeah.
And that's really the hardest thing is when you're you know, when you're a genre fan and genre really, really lets you down.
Uh-huh.
So, and that's the thing about horror movies is like, I think that sort of made me a little bit more picky about the horror movies I watch now, mm-hmm. just because like I love, I mean, it really is my favorite genre. But I won't just go see everything just
right.
because it's a horror movie at this yeah. point. So.
Well, let's get into the movie then.
Okay.
It's Suspiria, right? That's how you pronounce it?
Suspiria. Dario Argento's Suspiria.
So I watched it this morning.
Okay.
For the first time ever. I had seen clips here and there, and this is what I did for this one. I watched it this morning, but I didn't, like, dive into any side research because mm-hmm. I thought it might be fun to sort of rely on you.
Okay.
Because I'm sure you know your shit. But 1977, and the one thing I did find was the log line for the poster, which is great. The only thing more terrifying than the last 12 minutes of this film are the first 92. That was on the poster.
Yeah. It is like one of those movies that I think I told you when I emailed you about my pick. I'm like,
it was pretty funny. You said, Emily watch this.
Yeah. Because like you said, like she hates horror movies.
Yeah. Yeah. She wouldn't have made it through the first 6 minutes.
Oh, it's a
because it's
rough first. Yeah. I mean, that first Suspiria is. One other thing I said in the email is that Suspiria is a great movie without being a good movie.
Yeah.
It's like the plot is like doesn't really hold up to scrutiny.
Sure.
The acting for a number of reasons is like there's some really good acting in it.
Uh-huh.
Like Jessica Harper, the star, is mm-hmm. fantastic. And Joan Davis, I think is her name. She's not the head of the dance academy, but she's like
the number two.
Yeah,
both of those women were great. I thought.
Yeah,
the head and the subhead,
mm-hmm.
for lack of a better word.
Yeah, and there's like such a they're so good. But Joan Davis actually, she has her background is in old classical Hollywood. Like she was she was a star of a lot of like 1940s movies and some noir movies. So that's the thing is, but you have to go into it understanding it's more of a sensory experience than like a coherent film that you're going
to
watch.
And you also said to watch it loud.
Yeah.
And that's the other reason I waited instead of watching it last night in ideal situation at night in the dark or whatever. So it was a beautiful sunny day, but I cranked up – I got the Bose sound bar.
Oh.
And I cranked it up like there was no one in the house but me and the dogs. And it is – fucking like you talk about a sensory experience.
Yeah.
And I felt like that was a lot of the movie was just that. It was like, you're right. It wasn't about the plot. It was about sound and color
mm-hmm.
and just putting you in a emotional state.
Yeah. The thing about the sound, like the soundtrack was like the, like really driving and it really like,
oh, so good.
It's an amazing soundtrack. It's by an Italian band called Goblin.
Right. This is sort of what they're known for, right?
They've done other soundtracks, but yeah, this is like, I've listened to their other stuff and their other stuff is a lot more just straight prog rock.
Right.
And it's okay, but it's like not really my bag. But this, like this soundtrack is like, it's otherworldly. It's got like strange chimes and, electronic keyboard and bouzouki, which is used to vary. Bouzouki is like a Greek stringed instrument.
Oh.
And it's used to really interesting effect. And Argento actually asked Goblin to write the soundtrack before the movie was made.
Oh, interesting.
So that they, kind of put the cart before the horse. I think they made some adjustments after,
right.
After they saw it. But that was like, the main theme was created.
Yeah. So effective.
Yeah. And the other thing technically about it is that it was one of the last films, definitely the last film in Italy and may have been the last Western film to be shot with a three-strip emulsion process of Technicolor, which is like, it's really wonky,
uh-huh.
but what Argento wanted was he wanted these really vivid hues.
Yeah.
And
He got him.
Yeah, and he got him. Everything is like, you know, bathed in like really bright red or
Red, blue, and green were like the prominent, especially red.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's all over the place.
And then throughout the movie, he also talks about like there are other references, a lot of color references within the movie. You
know? Yeah, the red room.
Go to the yellow room. Professor Vertigast is, you know, the doctor. Uh-huh. Vertigast is, you know, if you break it down, Verde is green, is scare. It's an archaic use of the word scare.
Interesting.
It's like Shakespearean, but yeah. Which is also interesting because like, you know, there's also a lot of weird misdirection throughout the movie. Like they make a big deal like about Professor Vertigast. Well, should we go sort of walk through the movie for people who haven't seen it?
We can talk however we want. We can jump all around.
Okay. Let's go through a little bit. So I think it's like for people who don't know the movie, it's like it was like shot in like it was released in 1977 and it was like it's a horror movie that is centered around a dance academy in Munich, Germany. And then the lead, the heroine, or sort of not even much of a heroine. She does save the day at the end. Her name is Susie Banyan, played by Jessica Harper. She shows up at the Tanz Dance Academy. Also, Tanz is German for dance, so it's the Dance Academy. She shows up and as she's entering the school, this woman is running out.
Yeah.
And she can't – like she's like talking to the intercom. You can't hear anything. There's like thunder and lightning.
Oh,
and,
it's so like – I mean from the moment she is at the airport, it's just like – it makes you uneasy.
Yeah.
The sound and the wind and the rain, and she gets in the cab and the cabbie can't understand where she's saying to go.
It's funny.
And then he repeats back exactly how she said it.
Yeah. As soon as she gets in the cab, you know, she's trying to connect with this person and she's immediately, you know, it's apparent that she's immediately cut off from all human contact. Mm-hmm. She's like saying, Escherstrasse. He's like, was?
Yeah.
Oh, Escherstrasse.
It was so funny.
Also, just want to point out Escherstrasse, you know, I think of MC like Escher Street or I don't know what if Escher has a meaning in German, but I was thinking of MC Escher.
Oh, interesting.
And then a couple scenes later, they go to the bathroom where the first woman is killed and there's all that sort of Escher-esque like wallpaper, like the birds turning into other birds.
So. But there's just this discomfort from the very beginning.
Yeah.
And then when she arrives there and the lady is just going – like as she's approaching the door, this woman is just batshit out of her mind, runs through the woods. And it's just such a great setup, like setting the tone.
Yeah. And she can't even – it's funny because she gets there at night and she can't even get in. Like nobody will let her into the door.
Yeah.
So she has to go back and so she see – she's driving and she sees the woman running through the woods.
Uh-huh.
And then it like follows this woman. Okay. One thing about horror movies – this is my little aside. Some people – I like pretty much everything about horror movies. Some people one phrase that comes up with a lot of horror movie fans is, it's got these great kills.
Yeah.
And I'm just like, you know, it doesn't really – that doesn't really make a whole lot of difference to me usually. But man, does Suspiria have some great kills.
Dude, that first one –
oh, it's
is
bonkers.
Off – like just batshit crazy.
Yeah. It's like, you know – she's
– oh, my God.
She's left this – this woman has left the school and is like staying with a friend. She goes into the – oh, I think I wrote down the line of dialogue because it was so weirdly stilted. It all seems so absurd, so fantastical. Would you mind if I use the bathroom? anyway, she goes into the bathroom. She sees these eyes outside in the dark.
Yeah.
And then she's like – goes closer to the window to peer out.
Yeah,
and that's when
that
like the hands come through the window.
Oh my God.
Pulling her through.
That whole sequence was just like I mean when she's got her face pressed against the glass.
Yeah.
And the you think that's the worst of it.
Yeah.
And it just keeps escalating and how fucked up it gets.
Yeah. It's like even when she's pressed against the glass, it's not even like kind of pressed, like she's being smashing against the glass. You can see her face like smashed in the glass. You can see her like breath on the glass.
Uh-huh.
And then she's pulled through, stabbed a bunch of times. the
slow stabbing, which is super creepy.
Oh, gosh. Ugh. I mean, it's just funny because I've seen it so many times, but I still, like,
oh, I'm sure,
shudder every time I see that.
Yeah, stabbed directly into the heart.
Yeah.
A beating heart.
Right, which is, you know, obviously you couldn't have seen that.
Right.
But it's like, and then she's, while she's screaming, her friend is outside, like, going from apartment to apartment,
yeah,
like, help, there's a murderer, there's a murderer. Like, just, like, flailing and banging. It's like the way she's moving is really over-exaggerated, and it's just, like, it's so terrifying.
It is, and it's so loud.
Mm-hmm.
And like you said, it's just so kinetic and frenetic, and it just, like, it's upsetting, like,
yeah,
genuinely upsetting.
And it's,
even for kind of a schlocky, you know, 70s Italian horror film.
Yeah.
At the end of it, and I had heard about this first kill, you know, it's legendary.
Yeah.
And I had never seen it all the way through. And it after it finishes, in the middle of a bright sunny day in Atlanta, I just, like, found my fists were clenched, and out loud I went, Jesus fucking Christ.
It has that effect. It's just like,
yes.
I mean, it is like, that's why I love this movie, is because it's just, it's not, you know, it's smart for what it is.
Yeah.
And it's really, it's not just trying to be like, it's not trying to be clever.
Uh-huh.
It's trying to upset you.
Yeah.
And there's also some more upsetting details about it. Like, originally when they conceived this, he and his partner at the time, Dario Nicoletti, mm-hmm, I believe was her name, as it was conceived, the students at the Dance Academy were 10 to 12. They were, like, really young.
Good
and, like,
Lord.
You could not have made that movie.
With not even then.
Because they wanted – I mean, what they wanted to do is they wanted to make a fairy tale, which is – I mean, but there's all these things that, like, make sense when you – that falls into place when you – watch it. There's like this narration at the beginning that's sort of almost like once upon a time.
Yeah, yeah.
And then as they go through the halls of the Dance Academy, the set design, which is also just amazing and just really surreal,
mm-hmm,
the set design is such that, like, they placed doorknobs at about chest to head level.
Oh, interesting.
So that way people would look smaller.
There was something about it that I couldn't quite put my finger on.
Yeah.
That just sort of – and again, it's just – maybe it disorients you or just gives you a sense of discomfort.
Mm-hmm. And it does – it succeeds on all that – all those fronts. And then – so anyway, she – it slowly comes out that the school is not just a dance academy.
Right.
It's a coven of witches, and the head witch is
– which you don't learn until like 20 minutes out from the end of the film.
Right. And it's like it teases it out a little bit. I mean, the soundtrack is less than subtle because
sure.
There's parts of the soundtrack where it goes, witch, 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 witch. But, you know, the Coven of Witches is led by this one ancient witch named Helena Marcos who
right.
was, you know, in the you know, she was born in the 1800s.
Uh-huh.
And, you know, she took it over and supposedly died, but it has really been like – and that's – you know, it's not effective storytelling because, like, they don't really reveal enough about Helena Marcos for you to really be afraid of her.
Yeah.
That's just sort of like – you're like, you know, instead of the plot driving the scares, it's the atmosphere that's driving the scares.
Oh, man. So, the atmosphere for sure.
Yeah.
I mean, they have it all. They have the hulking – mute giant.
Yeah.
They have the creepy little boy.
Oh, yeah.
The headmistress type, you mm-hmm. know, a couple of them. Like all the – it's all there.
Yeah.
All the horror movies. I hate to say tropes, but I guess tropes.
Yeah, they are. I mean, it's like the creepy little boy who doesn't – you know, you don't really know what's going on with him. They have the – you don't know who's in on it or who's not. Like,
yeah, misdirection again.
Yeah, there's like the blind piano player who's
right.
Like, who is like, you think, oh, he's kind of unsettling looking. I wonder
yeah, yeah.
if he's in on it. Well, no.
No, he gets his neck chewed out by his own dog.
By his seeing eye dog. And the plaza they shot that was actually, that was a site of rallies that, of Nazi rallies.
Oh, really?
Like back in the 30s and 40s. And
wow.
Like, I've seen footage of, you know, you can see footage of it.
Of that place?
And, yeah. And it's just like, you know, it's, Hitler is addressing a crowd. There's like thousands and thousands and thousands of people feeling this. And then when you – but in Suspiria, when the guy dies, he's just alone in this gigantic plaza.
That was a great shot, that huge wide shot.
Yeah, which was a nightmare to light. Apparently they had to use these gigantic carbon arc lights to illuminate the buildings. And it took them a couple – you know, may have taken them a week to set everything up for that shot.
Yeah, like what kind of budget did this have?
I don't know, actually.
Huh.
It's a – I mean it made – it did make its – I mean it definitely made its money internationally. I know that like – I think it made over – you know, in 1977 dollars, made like $1.2 million in the U.S.
Right.
Which is pretty impressive for a low – not low budget, but for a horror movie.
Right.
Yeah, it's just like
– like some parts of it are really impressive, I think, visually. And I like movies sometimes, not always, but sometimes I like a movie where you can tell it's a stage set because it just sort of feels like make believe in like the right way.
Yeah.
And this sort of had that. Like the Dance Academy felt like I could just picture this like elaborate stage set, you know?
And that's the other – yeah. And it's – everything is – super, like the colors in it are super saturated.
Yeah.
The angles are really unusual. There's like all these like sort of deco flourishes and deco staircases that that are all over. And it's, but one of the interesting things about it is like you never, two of the films, you know, ordinarily, if it was an action movie, it would be to its discredit because when you're watching an action sequence, you want to have a good sense of space to know what's going on.
Yeah. And orient yourself.
Yeah. Like the Avengers, for example, has this. I would just watch it again, rewatch it again recently.
Uh-huh.
There's that great sequence. It's like a crane shot, or I don't know if it's a crane shot or it's like a digitally composited shot, where it's like it's like following all the action as they're fighting the aliens in New York, and it's like it goes from one hero to another.
Yeah,
and you see everybody like fighting, and you have a really good sense of what's going on in there. In Suspiria, there's no sense of space at all. Like,
yeah,
you don't know what. Like when somebody is pulled through a window, you don't know what, where they are exactly.
Yeah.
And that helps offset, you know, that helps set up the experience as a the unsettling experience.
Yeah, and I think the action of the film itself, like the plot is like I even wrote down in here that like it bugged me for a little while that I had no idea what was really going on.
Mm-hmm.
But then I think it sort of occurred to me that's what was keeping me so on edge and uneasy.
It's
because I didn't know what the fuck was happening.
Right. It's like there's not much. I mean, there are definitely a lot of third person omniscient shots where you can see things that the other characters can't see. But mostly you're just sort of following the experience of Susie Banyan.
Right.
And so you don't know what's going on necessarily.
Because she doesn't. Yeah.
Because she doesn't know what's going on.
Yeah.
You know, and there's all the – like I said, there's other bits of misdirection. The most famously is the maggot scene where
so good.
Like, you know, Susie Banyan is in her room just brushing her hair.
Uh-huh.
And then you see these little white things falling down into her hair.
Yeah.
And then she's finally like picks something out of her hair and it's just a close-up, really tight close-up of her thumb and forefinger. And there's like a writhing maggot that's like flopping back and forth between them. And then this music just like – like kicks on, and it shows. Then it cuts outside, and all the girls are like screaming out of their rooms.
Uh-huh.
And that's one other thing.
And it turned out to be like old food, right?
And it turned out to be old food that was in the attic that had nothing to do with the plot.
I know.
It didn't.
It was just upsetting. Is that why he did that?
I think so.
Misdirection.
It did. I mean, it drove one element, which is they're all. Instead of sleeping in their rooms, they all sleep in the gymnasium.
Yeah,
or
which sets up that great like nighttime silhouette.
Yeah,
that red silhouette shot.
Yeah, they set up sheets all around the sleeping girls.
Yeah,
and then that's when you first sort of halfway see Helena Marcos.
Right,
she's like behind, you know, like sleeping behind them, and you find out it's Helena Marcos because there's this long convoluted explanation. It's like, I heard her, and she was snoring, and that's her snore. It's just like.
It's like, sure.
Yeah. One, the actress who sort of delivered that line, her friend Sarah.
Yeah, Sarah.
Sarah is like, she was Italian. There's like a lot of Italian actors. There's some American actors. And then there's also Udo Kier, another German actor.
A young Udo Kier.
Yeah.
Young and handsome.
Yeah, he was really good looking.
Yeah.
Even I saw a making of documentary that was shot 20 years later, and he was still pretty good looking. A little bit, you know, a little bit more, I guess, you know.
Like threatening?
Yeah. But
I was surprised to see him, though, and see him like young and handsome. I was like, wow. Like he wasn't always just like super creepy.
Yeah. He was actually the good guy in this case,
which is crazy. Like when I saw that he was in the movie, I was like, "Oh yeah, Udo Kier."
Oh
like,
yeah, Udo Kier did it.
None creepier, and he's just like deliver some information, basically.
Yeah, yeah. Again, sort of half delivers half information.
Right.
When they shot that though, nobody like Udo Kier was speaking in German. The Italian actors were speaking in Italian. The American actors were speaking in English. So they were actually like – they dubbed over everybody's lines at the end.
Yeah, sure.
And so like it's not even people were mispronouncing dialogue. They just were doing it in their native tongue.
Yeah, you could tell like sometimes it was better than others.
Yeah. To me, that's just the craziest thing in the world. Oh, they also didn't do everything had to be done in ADR because they didn't do any on sound – they didn't do any sound recording on set. So.
Yeah, I mean, there was so much like wind and rain and things falling and breaking and like I imagine it was a sound nightmare.
Yeah.
Like on set.
Yeah, how would you have done that? I mean, especially, you know, you could go in and post and be like, oh, we'll just add the wind effects later. But like, no, you actually had physical wind buffeting the microphones. You had like
exactly.
Physical rain, like sheets of water just
yeah.
Like being poured down onto the, you know.
It was also extreme.
Yeah.
You know, it couldn't just be like rain. It had to be a rain that was like upsetting.
Yeah.
Almost.
There's a lot of water. There's a lot of water motifs in that too. Like you have the rain, like the giant rainstorms at the very beginning and the very end.
Right.
You have like water going down the drain and like, you know.
Yeah, yeah. When she cleans the blood out of the sink.
Yeah. And like water, you know, the swimming pool scene. Where
oh, right.
Which was shot. Most of the interiors were shot in Italy, but they went to Munich to shoot some exteriors,
mm-hmm.
and that pool was actually in Munich. I think it might have
been. Really.
It might have been an Olympic pool that they built for the 36 Olympics. I don't know. That's like
yeah.
That's half information. You should go research that yourself.
Well, it fits right in with this movie.
But yeah, it's such a good – I mean I make a habit of watching this every year around Halloween.
I think it's going to be on my list now, like my rewatch list.
Yeah.
It feels like a movie that you can see something unique each mm-hmm. time you watch it.
Yeah, absolutely. And it's also got like even the things that are kind of corny, like there's the Olga – the character of Olga who is just like – in it for a couple scenes and then she just disappears altogether.
Who is she?
She's the woman that is Olga is the roommate for the first night.
Then
she falls ill.
And then she just like kicks her out of her apartment?
Yeah.
Yeah,
and
yeah.
You never see her again. But there's that scene where they're in the dressing room and she's like, squawk, 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 Mara Harry wants to talk. And then later she's like, Susie. Sarah, I read somewhere that people's names begin with S are snakes. And then she starts hissing at the woman and
yeah.
The woman sticks her tongue out. And you know, meanwhile, Susie Banyan's behind them both as they're like
uh-huh.
getting like face to face. It's really funny and it's
yeah.
insane. But it's so – and it's also – it's funny but it's also unsettling because like why are these grown women acting
– yeah.
like, you know, like 6-year-olds.
Yeah. I mean, it had this thing where it was a fun watch while also being like deep, like legit disturbing.
Mm-hmm.
Like those kills, even like I said, is like a 70s sort of schlocky thing. It was like I found myself just my face was all twisted up when I was watching it.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just I was tight. I was nervous.
Mm-hmm.
That 70s blood, whatever they used to use back then,
yeah.
That color is just so like distinct and kind of unsettling.
Right. I mean, everybody talks about how they use – now if you have a low-budget horror movie, you use like a blend of like detergent, Karo syrup and red food dye.
Right.
With a little blue thrown in to make blood that pops.
Uh-huh.
But this doesn't look like that. This looks like tempera paint or nail polish.
Yeah,
it's just like, it is so thick and it just like – really, and it pools really heavily.
Yeah. It looks viscous.
Yeah. It looks viscous and like it's, you know, like you'll be scrubbing it for hours
right.
if you. Yeah. I just love this movie so much. It's just such, I mean, it's funny too because I would just like to point out that my other two favorite movies were already covered. Joe Randazzo covered RoboCop.
Oh, nice.
And I can't remember.
Go figure.
You know, it's funny.
Like, what was the other one?
Groundhog Day.
Oh, okay. Griffin McElroy.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And we had, because I was, so it seems sort of weird. Like, it seems like a, I mean, I guess this seems sort of like far, like choosing Suspiria seems sort of far afield from somebody who was a comedy.
Yeah, person. But I know you, so I wasn't surprised at all. Like, I know your love for this movie.
Yeah.
Another great kill that we have to talk about is Sarah.
Oh, God.
Who gets out of a room by stacking a bunch of suitcases on one another
mm-hmm.
and leaps from a window into a room stuffed with razor wire.
Yeah. It's like, why is there razor wire in this room? There's no – and it's also funny because, like, she's locked in this room
with
a simple – it's a simple, like – it's not a deadbolt. It's like
a little latch.
It's a latch that, like, falls down. And, like, the person on the other side of the door is, like, trying to open – like, push the latch up.
Yeah, for way too long.
Yeah, with a straight razor. And they can't quite get at it. So you're like, well, why don't you just stay there? Why don't you just, like, hold that down or whatever.
Yeah.
But no, she's like – she takes the time to stack that up. And then she falls into this room of razor wire. And it's sort of like the it's just like the scene in Ed Wood where Martin Landau falls in the pool with the octopus.
Yeah.
And he's like – has to sort of like pretend the octopus is alive. And that's the scene – that's the sense I got from this is like she's
totally.
Like, oh, like
yeah.
And that, like it was just wire. It's like if you look close – I mean if
yeah,
you look
there are no razors on
yeah, there's no razors. There's
yeah.
no barbs.
And then the razor comes out of nowhere and slits her throat.
Right. You don't know that there's somebody – suddenly somebody's in the room. You don't see the person enter. And the other one – I mean I keep on saying – and the other thing.
Right.
But I get really excited. you never know – I think it's important to talk about the violence in the movie because
yeah.
the violence is definitely – the victims are all definitely women.
Mm-hmm.
However – there are almost no men in this movie.
Right.
Like there are a couple. There's like the creepy Pavlo
mm-hmm.
is one of the guys. Like he's sort of the mute.
Right.
The mute sort of Frankenstein looking
yes,
guy.
With the new teeth.
Yeah. With the new teeth. He's so proud. But – and then there's like a dancer who – a male dancer who
right.
is – you know, you don't know if he's part of it or not.
Yeah,
he
doesn't
seem like he is because you never see him like do anything. You never know who's doing the killing. Like
yeah.
you just see a hand or you see like – or else you see the dog attacking the blind man.
Who is doing the killing?
Don't know.
Oh, okay.
It doesn't really – like it's never clarified.
All right. I didn't know if I missed out on something.
Nope.
All right.
You didn't miss anything. It's just like – it's just – there's just somebody being killed. So you never know if it's like a man who's doing the killing or a woman doing the killing. And considering the time and considering a lot of other slasher movies and giallo movies, none of the killings are sexualized, which
mm-hmm.
is something that my wife was like – pointed out to me. She's like, yeah, there's like all these women – not all. There's only like three deaths in the whole thing. But like the women who die, like they're not sexualized.
Yeah.
Nobody is shown topless. Nobody – there's
yeah.
there's nothing – there's none of the sort of tawdry elements that are associated with slasher films.
Right.
I mean, that's actually a misstatement of – that's a total misstatement. There are a lot of tawdry things that are associated with slasher films, but nudity and sexuality is not one of them. Like
right.
Nobody's being punished because they're sexual.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
You don't really know why they're being punished, for example. I mean, for
that's part of why it's so upsetting is there's
yeah.
no rhyme or reason to any of it.
Right. It's like Susie Banyan arrives and she's suddenly being targeted.
Right.
But for what? Like, when you sit there and think about it, it's like she's – the only reason she actually starts to take action is because they have deemed her a threat. And, you know, it's a very circular argument. Like, well, if we don't get her, she's going to
yeah.
she's gonna be a threat. But if – she's not a threat. We don't present ourselves, she wouldn't be a threat. You know, it's just – it's kind of ridiculous, but it's
– well, there is that one scene with Udo Kier and then the German professor kind of the only – I mean, that's where you get all your, all the information on kind of what's really going on. And he said that they this coven – coven, listen to me, American movie.
I don't want to call it coven. It sounds like oven.
This coven and the occult is what they keep saying in the movie instead of a cult. Mm-hmm. They gain wealth by causing – through like by causing suffering in others.
Mm-hmm.
And that's sort of the only time that's mentioned though.
Right.
As like – and essentially that could be the plot of the movie, which is like this coven lives on and gets wealth and gets rich by killing – like that's why these killings are happening.
Mm-hmm.
But it doesn't really revisit that. It just sort of lobs it out there.
Yeah. I think it's like, you know, it's – everything is a flimsy pretense for the effects.
Yeah.
Like you – he's less interested in making the story make sense as he is like sort of – punishing is the wrong word, but just really sort of like making you feel something.
Right.
And I think that's like – that's not – in some cases that's doesn't work. Like I said, the aforementioned New York Ripper.
Yeah, yeah.
Where it doesn't work. It just makes you feel like, ugh, this is just really gross and
right.
I'm not carrying anything away from this. And in some cases like this, it works really well.
Yeah. It's like a sensory experience. More than seeing a movie almost.
Yeah. It's like a, instead of being in a sensory deprivation tank, you're in a sensory overstimulation tank.
Well, and it's funny seeing today like so many movies are clearly owe so much to this.
Mm-hmm.
Like when I see something like The Witch or Hereditary, there's a lot of the DNA of this movie in those films, I think.
Yeah. And because they were – but they definitely didn't have the same violence. The violence is – you know, the violence of yeah. Hereditary, for example, is mostly unintentional and off-screen.
Right. Sure.
And, like, The Witch is, you know, again, the Witch is, like, it's most of the violence is hinted at. But they're just, like, they're really interested in just, like, those movies are interested in, like, doing the same thing, like, putting you off balance.
Yeah.
And, you know, oh, I think I've said before, I feel like we're in a golden age of horror right now where mm-hmm. we're just like – there's so many good, smart horror movies that are being made. I wonder what it's going to say about us because it's like right – when you look back at the horror movies like, you know, with the slash – the conventional slash movie where mm-hmm. people are being – you know, people are being punished for the, like Friday the 13th style for taking drugs or being mm-hmm. sexually promiscuous as – quote unquote. You know, it says about our, that says a lot about our reaction as a society to them, you know, and same with like the movies like Invasion of the Body Snatchers in the 50s.
Right.
That says a lot about like how our fears of communism, like what are the horror movies now saying about us as a society? Like,
right.
I think it's like, you know, that there are a lot of forces. There are forces that are out of our control that we just are powerless to stop. And I think mm-hmm. maybe that's, you know, there's definitely a sense of that. I mean, not in a supernatural or an occult way, but just like in a way of like, do we really, you know, do we feel like we have, we feel like we're, as we are supposedly being brought closer together by social media,
yeah.
we're sort of like being driven further apart and we're losing our agency and we don't have, you know, we don't feel like we have the power we once did,
uh-huh.
you know? So I think maybe that's what's going to come up in things like The Witch,
yeah.
for example. Like, or that's what you can read from stuff like The Witch. Get Out, though, that's a little bit more pointed.
Yeah.
Anyway.
New movie looks great.
I'm so fucking excited to see that. I can't wait.
I saw the trailer, too, for the other the guy who did Hereditary, his new one.
Oh, really?
Yeah, that's out.
When is the movie?
I'm not sure, but the trailer dropped like last week, and
okay.
it's another sort of folk horror. Hikers wander into this like sort of Swedish village where like there's some Wicker Man type shit going on.
Ooh, nice.
Yeah,
another covenant of witches.
Yeah, yeah. There's something happening there.
Help, Haman! Help! Oh, yeah. I've really loved being able to go see decent horror movies in the – I mean even some of the like the ones you wouldn't expect are good like is it Unfriended? There's like – there are two social media-based horror movies. There's like
– Yeah, I didn't see either one of those.
Yeah, one of them is – I hate
I think Unfriended is – I think that's it.
There's Unfriended and Unfriended Dark Web.
I don't know.
those two are actually really – those two I thought were really effective.
Oh, really?
Because it's like they have a gimmick, and the gimmick is everything you see transpires on the on a computer screen.
Oh,
so
okay.
Everything is within – like with Skype and with like email – like pictures being emailed and like, you know, the – Facebook posts and so on.
Uh-huh.
And the other one is like, I think, oh, Friend Request is the other one. And that's terrible. Do not watch Friend Request. That one is just hot garbage. Unfortunately, I decided to buy that one not because I had confused the two movies. And so I ended up with the bad, with a Blu-ray of the bad one.
Well, the end of this film is just, again, batshit crazy. Sarah comes back. With her like, – those pins in her eyes,
mm-hmm.
and those bolts through her wrists.
Yeah.
And she comes – not alive, but dead alive.
Yeah.
After her and
– As Sarah – or as Susie is confronting Helena Marcos.
Yeah, yeah.
Who is like
– full on witch at this point.
Right. You don't see – you can't see her. She's like silhouetted.
Yeah.
She draws back the curtain and she's invisible.
Yeah.
Until like the –
until she's stabbed, right?
Right. And like the – she's able to find out where she is because the – she's – sort of illuminated by a lightning flash.
Yeah.
She takes this bird, you know, this sort of crystal from a bird statue that she had knocked down.
Was that from the peacock lamp?
Yes.
Dude, I wrote here, God, do I want that peacock lamp.
It's so amazing. Yeah, it's beautiful.
It's gorgeous.
And that's, yeah. And it's like, so she uses that, stabs her through the neck.
Yeah, yeah.
Sarah disappears, and then everybody else starts to like, you know, it's like a Star Trek phaser shot where everybody's like, or like on the bridge, like rocking back and forth practically.
Right.
She runs back and the people are clutching their throats and bleeding from the eyes
oh,
and so
man.
On. And as she runs out, the whole thing is – and it's really distressing to me because like I just look at those interiors they made and they just destroyed them all in the final scenes.
Where yeah. Like, everything's just blowing up.
Yeah.
And that like, was all real stuff. Like I imagine that was a – I bet that was a dangerous set to be on.
She was terrified.
Yeah.
I read an interview where she was like, it was the scariest thing that happened to me. They told me what was going to happen. They walked me through it, but it's still so much stuff could have gone wrong.
It's like doors are literally getting blown off their hinges.
Uh-huh.
Statues are like exploding.
Yeah. It's like even if you do it safely, there are shards of wood and ceramic flying everywhere. And you could really injure yourself that
like
way.
You get it was very visceral. You got the sense of her distress as an actor.
Yeah,
like that seemed real.
Yeah, it was very much real.
Yeah.
she's also in another one of my favorite movies, which I haven't seen in a long time, so I say my favorite movies is just, but it's one of those that I just loved to pieces when I saw it, and I just remember some certain scenes from it very much. My Favorite Year.
Oh, sure.
Yeah.
Yeah, Peter O'Toole, man.
Peter O'Toole, Jessica Harper, and Marklyn Baker.
Yep, he was so great.
Yeah. There's a scene in that where Peter O'Toole and Marklyn Baker are trying to climb up a building to get into this, like, fancy party.
Yeah.
And there's these two, like, New York socialites are sitting up there, like, talking, like, very sophisticated. Like, you know the actor Alan Swan? He's beneath us. Because they're climbing up and trying to get up there.
Right.
And the other guy's like, well, of course they're beneath us. He's an actor.
Such a great dumb joke.
I know.
I just love it.
I did too. Oh, it's such a good movie.
Oh, boy. All right, dude. Well, we finish up with five questions, as you know.
I do know.
First movie you remember seeing in a theater.
The first movie I remember seeing in the theater is I must have been like 6 or 7, and it was Paper Moon of all things.
Ah, great film.
I was like, am I crazy? Like that, and I've gone back and looked it up. I was like, I remember seeing this in a movie theater.
Yeah.
But it came out in like 1972. Why would I have seen this? And it's like then I remembered, oh well, you know, at the time you didn't have like things didn't come out like 1,000 prints flooding the theaters
right.
all at once. Things would sort of like travel around
and
prints would go from place to place. And, you know, in a small town of 5,000 people, Paper Moon would show up in, you know, 3 years later.
Right.
So I remember seeing that and I was like, again, I thought, oh, maybe I'm kind of misremembering that. And then I went and watched it on an airplane and I was like, oh, nope, I remember a lot of this. So, Yeah.
Paper Moon. All right.
Yeah, my mom took me to that.
First R-rated movie.
My mom took me to my first R-rated movie as well.
Okay.
And it was John Boorman's Excalibur.
Oh, great movie.
It is, but it also has a really upsetting rape scene right at the beginning.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And my mom was like, close your eyes.
Yeah, that's a tough one.
Yeah. I was like, ooh. And then it's like the—
That was a definite hard R.
It was a hard R. I'm surprised she took me to it. But yeah. I think it was like, you know, I think she knew that I was, you know, I had an interest in—
Sure.
—fantasy and science fiction,
yeah,
and horror.
Yeah.
So she was, you know. And then, like, so that was uncomfortable. And then, like, decades later, we went to see, oh, shoot, what's the name of the movie? It's Angelica Houston, John Cusack, Melanie Griffith.
The Grifters?
The Grifters, yeah. Yeah. Where at the end, it's, you know, Angelica Houston tries to seduce her son. And I'm just like, I don't want to be watching this with my mom. This is really uncomfortable.
Oh, and then you went home and watched David O. Russell spanking the monkey just to finish off that Freudian nightmare.
Let's get out of here and get into something a little bit more relaxing.
All right, number three, do you walk out of a bad movie?
I have walked out of one bad movie.
Oh, man, what?
I don't know if you're going to like this. It was Oliver Stone's The Doors. Because I was just – I think I – it was – It was a free screening at the University of Wisconsin. I remember going there. And to me, like, getting a free movie ticket was like a huge deal.
Oh, sure.
I felt like, yeah, I'm going to get to see a free movie. And that was the most exciting thing in the world. And then I just felt like I was just being subjected to this sort of this narcissistic, self-destructive guy. And I was just like, you know what? Fuck this. I can't take this anymore. I'm out. And then I, you know, and I, you know, I – But I haven't walked out of a movie since then.
Oh, wow.
Because I'll always just like sort of tough it out through to the end and, you know. I even sat through Howard the Duck in the theater.
Number four, I tailor to the guest. And I'm going to go with what is your favorite American horror film?
Well, it's funny you should ask. My guilty pleasure movie is
did you have one for guilty pleasure?
I did.
Okay.
So I'm just going to shoot it out there anyway, and then I'm going to answer your question. My guilty pleasure movie is Heavy Metal.
Oh, yeah.
The
yeah.
animated movie, because I know it's terrible. There's some good – there's some great animation.
Uh-huh.
There's some – it's got a stellar cast like John Candy, Eugene Levy. It's – I think Cheech and – are Cheech and Chong in it? Anyway.
Probably.
It's got a great cast, but it's just so dumb. It's like you want it to hold together. There's a couple really good segments, but it's just like – but I'll watch it every once in a while. I'll be like, oh, this is terrible. But am I wrong?
Right.
And I'll go back and watch it again. I was like, nope, it's a terrible movie still.
Great poster though. One of the great posters of all time.
It is so good. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Lochnar.
Yeah.
But
– Yeah, favorite American horror
Favorite American
horror,
horror movie. I'd have to say it would probably be Evil Dead 2 because Evil Dead it's interesting because like I think you have the spectrum of Evil Dead, Evil Dead 2, Army of Darkness.
Mm-hmm.
And Evil Dead I think is really good.
Mm-hmm.
But it's a little, you know, its budgetary constraints show a little bit more. Evil Dead or Army of Darkness is funny and action-y, but it's a little bit too slapsticky for me, but Evil Dead 2 is just it's that sweet spot because it's just like it's got these this great physical comedy of like the great physical comedy of Bruce Campbell. Like he's such a good physical actor.
Yeah,
like the way he moves like in the scene with like where he's in the laughing room.
Yeah, yeah.
And he's like sort of mimicking the lamp like like going up and down. He's able to – like his face just looks so horrified and contorted. It's funny. It's scary and it's like it makes – it like is a well-executed – like it's a well-executed plot, well-executed everything. But there's so many other good movies like Get Out – like as the aforementioned Get Out, like The Witch, you know, the original Halloween. I liked the Halloween remake.
I did too. I liked it.
Yeah. It was fun to see, you know – It was fun to see all that. Like, it's fun to see people taking it seriously.
Mm-hmm.
And like I said, I will go see. I won't go see every horror movie, but I will go see a lot of horror movies.
Yeah. And finally, movie going 101. What's your routine, Joe?
Okay. My routine has changed slightly because our there are a couple local theaters. Like there's one in Woodstock and there's one in Saugerties,
mm-hmm.
but they only show movies like in the evening,
mm-hmm.
and which is great. Saugerties has a $5 cheap movie night where you go on Mondays and Thursdays. And,
yeah.
But I won't go to that because it's like, I'd rather be home. You know, I'm getting older. And so my wife and I always go to see matinees whenever possible. But our local like mall theater closed down recently. Mm-hmm. And so we've had to go further.
For the matinee.
Yeah. So it's like it happens a little less often. And the theater is a little bit smaller. We wind up at it as a little bit smaller. But I always try to go as dead center as possible because at some point I got fixed in my head. You know, maybe when I was studying film and video in college, like, you know what? You should be in the center because, like, that's where you have the best vantage point, the best viewpoint, and, like, this, you get the full effect of all the sound. So
right.
I'll always do that. And then we'll always get – I always used to get, you know, maybe just get – a popcorn and maybe a soda or something like that. But ever since my wife and I were dating, we get a large popcorn and a large soda.
Mm-hmm.
The popcorn has to have tons of butter. She made a great comic about that, where it's like you don't know. It's just like six panels of her. You don't know what she's talking about, but it's just like each panel, she's like, just pretend you're drowning a small animal in there. enough to make it seem like it's really unhealthy.
Yeah.
And then at the very end, it shows her.
It's revealed.
It shows her at a self-serve butter machine. It's going glurk, 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 glurk.
Yeah.
So we get a popcorn with a lot of butter. And then we also get like the soda is always a large. And I've been trying to get – I don't like to have caffeine usually – well, as I drink this caffeinated soda.
Right.
But I try not to have caffeine after a certain point in the day.
Mm.
So I'll get like – the pink lemonade and seltzer mixed. So it's not quite as sweet. And that's my jam. That's what I love to – that's like such a solid tradition.
Nice.
Yeah. I don't – I mean I my mall theater is supposed to open up. It looks like they're doing some work, some renovation.
Oh, okay. So it didn't go away.
Yeah. It went away, but I think it's going to – somebody's reopening it.
Cool.
Yeah. So, yeah.
Awesome, man.
Yeah,
thanks for coming in.
Thanks for having me. You know, it goes without saying, I love the show so much. And
thanks,
I'm so
dude.
Happy you agreed to have me.
Yeah, you know, we'll meet up. Maybe you can do like a horror movie special. We'll meet up in New York or something in the fall, and we can put it out in October.
Well, I would love to do that.
All right, man. We'll do it.
All right. Thanks, John.
All right, everyone. I hope you enjoyed that. It was so good to catch up with Joe, and if we had too much of old pals catching up in there, I'm sorry, but that's what we do in here, everyone. We have a conversation, just two people turning their phones off and talking to each other. Sometimes it'll go down that path, and I had a great time catching up with Joe, seeing what he's up to these days, and I really mean it when I say this. That era of The Onion, where Joe worked there for all those years, with Todd Hanson and Joe Randazzo and Carol and that whole crowd that I got to meet and befriend, Baratunde, it was a very special moment in time. And I put it up there with the heyday of the Harvard Lampoon back in the 1970s and in the 80s when the state got together and formed a comedy collective. Like, I believe it really does stand out as one of the great groupings of talent in one place. And that would have been in their office in Soho in New York City. So thanks to Joe for coming in here. Such a good dude. I'd like to have him in here again next time he comes through town. And we'll talk about another horror movie. Maybe we'll do some horror movie specials with Joe in the future. Very endearing, lovable guy. If you knew Joe, you would feel the same way. So I hope you all enjoyed that. Check out Suspiria. It's a tough one. So watch it during the daytime like I did on a nice sunny day. That's what I would recommend. Takes a little bit of the edge off. So thanks for listening. Until next time, I would advise you not to sign up for the creepy German Ballet Academy. Don't do it. Movie Crush is produced, edited, and engineered by Ramsey Yunt. Here in our home studio at Pont City Market, Atlanta, Georgia, for iHeartRadio.
For more podcasts from iHeartRadio, visit the iHeartRadio app, Apple Podcasts, or wherever you listen to your favorite shows.